I'd like to start by thanking my teacher, Mr. Goenka, who taught me everything that I will be talking to you about. Often when I talk about Vipassana meditation, I'm asked to talk about it from the standpoint of a psychiatrist and to discuss the therapeutic or the psychotherapeutic-like benefits or the comparison of psychotherapy to meditation. Tonight I decided to talk from a different angle. The angle of the psychotherapeutic benefits is very important and very interesting. But I actually spent the afternoon at the prison facility in northern Seattle, which is holding Vipassana courses for its residents. And so we spent a lot of time discussing that. And I thought I'd start tonight just by telling you more about my vacation in Newfoundland. And the challenge will be to see whether I can make that relevant to Vipassana. Well, my wife and son and I spent our summer vacation in Newfoundland. Newfoundland could be defined as the place that's in the Western Hemisphere that's farthest from Seattle. It's very striking to collect a few facts about Newfoundland. The Atlantic Ocean narrows in the north, and Newfoundland is closer to Ireland, much closer to Ireland than it would be to Seattle. So we tend to think of ourselves in the Western Hemisphere and Europe is in a different hemisphere. But Newfoundland is actually much closer to Europe. And culturally, that has proven to be true, and I'll say a little more about that. But geologically, it's also true. The island of Newfoundland is on the fault line where the vast plates that form the crust of the Earth come together, just as the western rim of the Western Hemisphere is a fault line, so the great San Andreas Fault in California and all the volcanoes you have up here, like Mount Rainier, they're all here because there's a crack in the earth at the edge of Washington, Oregon, and California. So there's also a crack in the Atlantic Ocean, and a little piece of the European plate of the world is actually part of Newfoundland. So geologically, Newfoundland is part of Europe and Africa just as much as it's part of North America. And the posters that the Canadian government puts out to advertise the island of Newfoundland, they refer to it as the Galapagos of geology. So the Galapagos were the islands where Darwin discovered evolution. They're the most important biological reserve in the world, and Newfoundland is one of the most important geological sites in the world. In fact, the theory of plate tectonics, by which we know how the planets growth and change occurred, most of that was actually deducted by trying to figure out why there were rocks in Newfoundland that resembled the rocks of Europe and Africa and not the rocks of North America. One of the most interesting places in Newfoundland is on the very northern tip. Newfoundland is a more or less round rock, but coming out of its western side, there's like a long finger that sticks up, very dramatic piece of geography. And at the very tip of that finger, there's a very important cultural site. About 1960, the governor of Greenland is a Danish colony, still a Danish colony. The governor of Greenland, who is a Danish nobleman, very wealthy, built a ship with his own money, a large ocean-going vessel. He sailed to Virginia and started sailing north along the east coast of the United States. And every harbor, every cove, he would ask people, do you know of any old ruins, any interesting mounds, any interesting archaeological sites? And he would explore anything people told him about, and he didn't find what he was looking for. He got to the northern tip of Newfoundland and asked that question, and some old Newfoundlander said, yes, there's some old Native American ruins, just some holes in the ground, but you can see they're mounded up. They must have been a village. And the Dane said, take me to that site. The Newfoundland fellow took him there, and the Dane noted that these old house sites had right angle corners. Native Americans do not build right angle corners. Very conveniently, this Danish nobleman had a wife who was a professional archaeologist. And she dug up these sites. This was in 1960. And that area is now a United Nations World Heritage Site. World Heritage Site means a a site of the greatest value to humanity. There's maybe 100 or so of these sites in the world. That is the only authenticated Norse village in North America. When I was in high school, and I look around the audience, I see, well, quite a few people here were in high school before I was, but most people were in high school after I was. There was a theory that the Norsemen came to the United States, or to the Western Hemisphere. But in 1960, it was proven. At this site in northern Newfoundland, they found an iron foundry. People were actually forging iron. Clearly could not have been Native Americans. And little pieces of Norse clothing and pieces of metal that fit the Norse pattern. For example, the Norsemen wore a cape, and then they would pin the cape together with a very classic Norse pin. And one of those Norse pins was found at the site. So we know that Norsemen actually were in the Western Hemisphere, came from Greenland. That site, through radiocarbon dating, can be dated to 1000 AD. So almost exactly 1000 years ago, Europeans sailed into the Western Hemisphere for the first time. Actually, if you look at a map, you see how it's possible to do this in an open boat. The Norse, I had forgotten this, and it's kind of an obscure bit of history that we do study in school and then forget. The Norse were ruling all of the British Isles. The King of England was a Norseman about 1000 AD. So they sailed from Britain. If you go north from Britain, you follow the Shetland Islands, then it's a very short hop to Iceland. From Iceland, it's a short hop to Greenland. From Greenland, it's kind of a big hop. That's the big obstacle. You have to cross the Davis Straits, very ice cold. But you get to Baffin Island. From Baffin Island, you coast down to Labrador. And from Labrador, you get to Newfoundland. That's how they did it. That's 1,000 years ago. This stirred up a tremendous interest in Newfoundland archaeology just in the past approximately four decades. Before that, Newfoundland was totally ignored. And archaeologists have been going wild up there. And the next interesting thing about Newfoundland, so one interesting thing is Europeans landed there, definitely, it's not a theory, 1,000 years ago. Next interesting thing is 7,000 years ago, Native Americans arrived. There were Native Americans in Newfoundland for 7,000 years. But there's a couple of interesting features about their archaeology. Archaeologists can separate Native American cultures by the kind of tools, by the kind of artifacts, and also by the diet that's implied by the remains of the animals that have been eaten. And it's been established that there were at least four different major civilizations or groups of people who inhabited Newfoundland, each one lasting for 1,000 or more years. So people who lived in the same place for a long, long, long time. 1,000 years, some of them 2,000 years, which is quite remarkable if we look at, say, the history of Seattle, for example. These Native American cultures varied. Some of them are what's called paleo-Eskimos. Eskimos, by definition, are peoples who specialize in living off the sea. So paleo-Eskimo remains show people eating only things like seals and whales. There are also paleo-Indians. Indians, by definition, live off the land as well as the sea. So those peoples were living on caribou and wolf as well as whales and seals. So there were at least four major groups. And one of the big questions is, if they could live so long and survive so well, why did they die out? It's totally unknown. And if they died out and there was a bad place to live, then why did some other group eventually arrive and live there for thousands of years? It's totally unknown. The major theory is that the edge of the pack ice is the ice that forms in the Arctic and forms a solid mass on the ocean. The edge of the pack ice at different times has been at the Newfoundland border. The pack ice to us from temperate zone is a pretty horrible place, exceedingly cold and windy, but it's an extremely fertile ecosystem. It's where the Arctic waters meet the temperate waters, where the ice meets the land. It's filled with whales and seals and polar bears. It's a prime hunting ground for a hunter-gatherer. So one theory is as the pack ice would rise and fall, these native peoples would come and go. When the pack ice receded, it's too bad, everybody dies. There's no more food. But if the pack ice stays at that zone for 1,000 years, you can live there for 1,000 years. So it's remarkable to walk around on this still rather desolate semi-inhabited island, trace your way through European history back 1,000 years, have to understand who the kings of England were, how ships were built in Europe 1,000 years ago, what kind of metals they were making, what kind of pins they wore. Then you go back into Paleo-Indian life, Paleo-Eskimo life, the history of the pack ice, the rise and fall of different peoples, each one of whom must have imagined their life was quite permanent. Seems like you could be living in one place for 1,000 years, you'd have a vast history of that place, you'd have ancestral graves, you'd think you knew everything about that place, you'd feel deeply rooted there. And how could you conceive of the idea that you would be completely wiped out? The only thing left would be an arrowhead or a bone of something that you ate. If we go back a little further, Newfoundland was entirely covered by ice during the Ice Age. During the continental glaciation, Newfoundland is far enough north that it was totally, nothing was there except mile-thick ice, as was true even as far south as New England, where I live. If we go back, if we really accelerate our cycle of historical geological regression into Newfoundland history, we get back to that time, which I referred to initially, in which Newfoundland was on the edge of the vast floating tectonic plates. The Earth is formed of several large plates that are fit together, just like the bones of our skull. We got several big bones, and they fit together into a puzzle, and they form the round shape of our head. So the Earth is a round shape formed by a handful of big plates. And one of those big plates, the crack, is right at Newfoundland. And when it was coming together and cracking apart, when they came together, it formed one great continent. The Earth at that time had only one continent, which geologists today call Pangaea. And there's a comical t-shirt you may see if you go to Newfoundland that says, "People of Pangaea, unite." When Pangaea was coming apart, it must have been an exciting time. There was no one there to see it, however. But the crack was so big that a piece of the Earth's mantle, the crust is the outer part. We're walking on the crust. Crust is hard, and it's sort of solid. The mantle is semi-liquid. Some of the mantle oozed up onto the surface of the Earth. So there are places where you can walk in Newfoundland where there are rocks, so-called poisonous rocks. They're not poisonous, meaning they don't jump up and bite you, but nothing can grow on them. They're incompatible with life. They come from the zone where life does not exist and cannot exist in the mantle of the Earth. The chemical constituents of the rocks are such that no plant can live on them. Those mantle rocks came onto the surface of Newfoundland about 350 million years ago. It didn't happen in 1 minute, so the exact millions of years is somewhat approximate. It, in itself, the process took millions of years. We took a very spectacular hike into what's called the Long Range Mountains of Newfoundland. These are very striking mountains. They have what's called a frontal escarpment. That means they rise up abruptly out of the earth. A very dramatic sight. They're quite small, but the abruptness of their rise makes them seem dramatic. And they give the impression of being extremely ancient. They are so eroded and worn down and gnarled and wrinkled, and the shapes are so sinuous. And indeed, these mountains are among the oldest parts of the Earth's surface. So as the Earth's surface has changed and the crusts have risen and fallen and the plates have come together, all the rocks have been washed away or rebuilt or reformed or damaged or eroded. Very few places are the very, very ancient rocks left. But on the surface of the Long Range Mountains of Newfoundland are some of the oldest rocks in the world. If you climb up into these mountains, you get into a zone way, way above tree line, Arctic tundra. Even though Newfoundland itself is quite far south of the tree line, these mountains, the added altitude, puts you above tree line. You're walking among barren rocks, barely covered by a few inches of moss. Sometimes there'll be a tree 1 or 2 inches high you can recognize. Well, it's a birch tree or it's a spruce tree, but it's so savaged by the wind. The soil is so poor, it's just like a little piece of tundra. And living on the top of the mountains are these wild woodland caribou. Woodland caribou, unlike the vast Arctic barren lands caribou, the tundra caribou live as individuals, isolated individuals, wandering here and there alone, just eating little bits of the tundra, an extremely majestic and eerie animal, seemingly as old as the rocks, of course, not literally, but ancient in appearance. And everywhere the rocks are exposed, so there's this emerald green grass, tiny micro trees, and then vast amounts of rocks, all looking as if they were stacked up by some cyclops, some Roman architect, playing with gigantic toys. And the rocks are all cracked and broken, lying at strange angles. They've lived through infinite glaciations, the formation and breaking up of Pangaea and many other continental shapes. It is said that the rocks on top of the Long Range Mountains are 1,200,000,000 years old, whatever that means. So we climbed up onto these mountains and were wandering around and would sit down on top of some rock. It was windy everywhere. We'd try to find a rock near some other rock that would break the wind and then just sit there and think, what does it mean that these rocks are 1,200,000,000 years old? How many changes have these rocks seen? The Earth itself had nothing that we would recognize as life. The biologists say there may well have been life. It used to be said there was no life before 500 million years ago. That was the edge of the Precambrian. Now, biologists have pushed back life, but by life they mean little tiny things smaller than the visible eye. There were no caribou. There were certainly no people. 1,200,000,000 years. Change in the shape of the continents, change in the quality of rocks, change in the shape of the Earth. An unbelievable reminder of the dimension of time and of life. I have always, since childhood, had thoughts like that. I think most people do. You read a geology book or you read a history book about the Norsemen. I'd read about the ancient Egyptians and I'd think, well, where was I then? Or if I wasn't anywhere, then where was I when I was nowhere? Or if there were no people then where were they? Or what could it mean? What could my life possibly mean? I don't really understand why I'm doing what I'm doing or what the purpose of anything is if the world is 1,200,000,000 years old. Will it live another 1,200,000,000 years? What will our life mean 1 billion years from now? Or if there won't be any life 1 billion years from now, what will that mean? Incomprehensible. Every plan or thought or action that we have as an individual or that we have as a society is based upon the repression of reality by a consensual agreement that it is too upsetting and disorienting to actually focus our minds upon the reality of the incredible change upon change upon change, which is the inescapable nature of the reality in which we are actually caught. That was all a lead into Vipassana meditation. Vipassana is a meditation that is based upon that reality. Having been provoked and troubled by such thoughts through my youth, I searched for some way to integrate reality with my life. Not really because I wanted to, not really because I was philosophical, but because it seemed essential. Why join some agitated group delusion? Why live for some supposed purpose that has absolutely no meaning whatsoever? Why be delirious with anger to protect your nation or a certain group of people or to promote a certain form of government when it's all so insubstantial? The only thing that I have ever found that satisfied my sense of integrating my daily life with reality, or to be somewhat melodramatic, we could say ultimate reality, is Vipassana meditation. So I want to talk about Vipassana from the standpoint of being not a religion, not a philosophy, but a practice of living with ultimate reality that gives meaning to immediate reality. The biggest step from geology, these planetary metaphors that I've been playing with, the biggest step from geology to Parshana has to do with the fusion of the numinous and the ethical. There was a philosopher of religion, a historian of religion, actually, at the University of Chicago, Mircea Eliade. He was an author of many, many books. He pioneered the field of comparative religion starting early part of the century and wrote books over a long time, died only about a decade ago. He classified religions into two major groups. One major group of religions are those that organized people around the manipulation of other powers. There's some big guy up there, he's got some power, he's either the chief king or the biggest god, and if I shake these bones right, if I say this prayer right, if I do this dance right, I will make him be on my side. Religion begins essentially as a form of coercion, magical coercion. The ritual compels the divine into being on your side. But the second major stage of religion into which the major religions of the world are supposed to fit come under the heading of those religions that fuse the ethical and the numinous. That is to say, the numinous, the spiritually enlivening, the moving, emotional, powerful, spiritual part of religion, has to be combined with ethics. In the second stage of religious life, we don't try to coerce gods, we try to follow their laws, get along with them, do the right thing. And that will put us on their side. Vipassana meditation is an extension of that. Its history in this planetary era goes back into the days of ancient India, when India was moving away from the first stage of religion. Ancient Indian religion, the Vedic religion of India, was a magical coercive religion. If you sacrificed a horse in the right way, with the right kind of fire, with the right kind of ceremony, the gods of the heavens would have to protect your armies. And about 600 or 800 BC, the peoples of India began to look upon life in a different way and began to consider the ethical importance of religion. Well, maybe we can't coerce gods into doing things just by sacrificing a horse. Maybe we should be doing some nice things for the people around us, and maybe the gods will like us better, and that way they'll protect our army. In that era of time, there arose a person known to history as the Buddha, who eliminated the step about the gods, neither denying their existence, but neither giving any importance to them, and said that the only way that a human being's heart and mind can be integrated to live with the ultimate reality of time is to practice ethics to its highest possible extension. The difference between geology, mere speculation about time, walking around on those majestic tundra barrens, and thinking, what is the meaning of my life? The difference between that and having a daily meditation practice that can root you in ultimate reality, the difference is not a magical, coercive practice that you trick your body through some meditation tactic. The difference is in the practice of the ethical. That's the fusion of the numinous and the ethical. So if we go back to Vipassana meditation, Vipassana is a meditation that is based upon reality, just reality, nothing other than reality. There's no religion, there's no God, not that a God may or may not be real, but we don't have the clear fact. And the focus of the meditation is not any religion, not any philosophy, not even geology. It's a focus upon change. Change, constant change, change upon change, just like you see or feel if you go to Newfoundland. The focus of Vipassana is the reality of eternal change, incessant change, within your own mind and body. You yourself become the Newfoundland. You yourself become the Galapagos of reality, the experimental site in which you experience the ultimate truth. However, in order to have that realization, in order to meditate upon that truth in an interior, personalized, meditative, internal manner, the first and the essential and the critical step is to live a life that is primarily attuned to the feelings and well-being of others around you. That step is not obvious from geology. that's the discovery of Vipassana, or we could say of any civilized life, of which Vipassana is a focalized and conscious expression. So if you were to go to a 10-day Vipassana meditation course, you would find, I'm not going to describe it in vigorous detail because there's all kinds of information around here and I want to stick to its sort of its flavors. The first step in taking a Vipassana meditation 10-day course is to take the vows of moral lifestyle, not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to commit sexual misconduct, and not to use intoxicants. Now, I'm just going to pick one of these and use it. Again, I'm playing with metaphors tonight that will capture some of the spirit and flavor of Vipassana from a different angle, but from an angle I hope that will be evocative and also seem compelling. It did happen that as we were hiking in the Long Range Mountains and staring in wonder and contemplating in awe, a very lucky moment happened, and that is that I was looking over the crest of a ridge. The ridge is there, unlike the mountains around here. The ridges there are just more rocks, more tundra, just endless, endless world of rock and little low grass and wind-whipped clouds, very incessantly windy. And I looked up, and sticking over the top of one of the ridges, I could see something that looked like the branches of a tree. But as I mentioned, there's no trees because we were above the tree line. And because I could see those branches, I actually could be aware that there was a woodland caribou right there. They have a color that's hard to describe. You could describe it as sort of a brown or a tan or a gray. They're mottled. They're not one color. They're more mottled than a deer or a moose. They look like those ancient rocks, and naturally that's some kind of protective coloration that derived over time. So you can be standing right near a caribou and not see it. And in winter, their coat changes and becomes more white, so they also have that protection in winter. But the only way you can pick them out is by their antlers. Now, we had a long, long time up there to sit and watch that caribou who was standing and watching us. He didn't move at all. He was frozen. I guess that's a protection against predation. And it gave me an opportunity to contemplate the long, millions of year long life that this species of mammal has had upon our planet. Now, supposing that my attitude had been the attitude of a hunter, not so much a hunter-gatherer as a modern hunter, the contemplation, the feeling state evoked in me would have been entirely different. As it was, the feeling state evoked in me was a feeling of similarity and kinship. Similarity, we're basically the same thing. My hair is not quite as long as his antlers, but we're similar. We're both transient collections of matter, living for a short period of time, wandering around looking for some food, probably having a family. There's a kinship between all living things. On the other hand, if I had the attitude of a hunter, even if I were not hunting, it wasn't hunting season, there would not be a feeling of kinship. There would not be a communion. Or if there were a communion, it would have been a hierarchical or user's communion. I just create that moment as a metaphor for this discovery, the discovery of civilization, the starting point of Vipassana practice, the life of Vipassana, the fusion of the numinous and the ethical. The fact that it is the feeling of communion, the feeling of identity with life, we could say the feeling of compassion, the feeling that every life is just like ours, whether it's human or animal or even otherwise, how that immediately brings us into a recognition both of our own vulnerability and our own commonality with all living things. So the ethical posture is the real step that brings Vipassana alive. I spent some time on that because, of course, today there are many kinds of meditation, and I'm not against any other kind of meditation, but to talk about contacting reality, a meditation that's truly based upon reality with nothing added, nothing taken away, just reality, the true reality of change in all things at all times, to experience that reality in the human heart, the gateway to that experience is the feeling of communion and kinship with all living things. The attitude of compassion awakens and enables that attitude towards oneself. The second step in a Vipassana meditation course is to, after having taken these vows, to spend 3 days in silence. The whole 10-day course is taught in silence. And the first 3 days of silence, you focus on your breathing, the breath going in and out of your nose, during which time you become extremely restless, bored, and feel like you're being driven crazy. Now, why go to such an incredibly trivial event after such grand concepts? And there's a reason. The first thing that blocks a human being from living in reality is the absence of an ethos of love and compassion. Once that ethos is established in your heart, the communion of reality can be felt. The common bond we have with every living thing is our transiency, our vulnerability, their vulnerability. The second thing that blocks us from a profound awareness of reality is our inability to concentrate. We are constantly distracted by other concerns than ultimate reality. Not that that's wrong. Of course, we all have many, many concerns that do need to be fulfilled, like how to get a roof over our heads, how to get food on our table. Not that other concerns are wrong, but if we are continuously subject to and prey to trivial reality, how can we ever get to ultimate reality? So Vipassana practice first consists of ethical vows and ethical feeling states, and second consists of practicing meditation that's focused on breathing with the goal of being able to remove your mind from your daily distractions and to focus it upon the subtlest, softest, immediate sensation in one's body, the feeling of breath going in and out, trying to attend to that without any distraction. And the goal is to be able to become master of one's own mind, not to have one's mind controlled by external events that call the mind away, but to be in the opposite state, to be the master of the mind, to say, I will place my mind here, I will keep it here, and I'm in charge. I can do that. Actually, you can't do that. It's very difficult. The next week of a Vipassana meditation course, 10-day introductory course, the next week consists of practicing awareness of the sensations of one's own body. And as one practices awareness of the sensations of one's own body, one is also becoming aware of one's own mind, since the mind and body are connected. Vipassana, the uniqueness of Vipassana, is that it is meditation only upon reality. That means there's no mantra, there's no imagery, there's no religious ideology, there's no belief system, there's no philosophy. The focus of meditation is, what is the nature of the ultimate reality of my mind and my body? If you simply make the effort to practice Vipassana, and that means to observe the sensations of your body and see what you learn, every human being will learn the same thing. We're all different in many ways. So somebody will learn, well, I got a backache, and somebody else will learn, I don't have a backache. Somebody else will learn, I can sit still for an hour pretty easily, and someone else will learn, it's very hard for me to do that, I have to keep working at it. But everyone will learn one thing that's the same, and that is every single second, your body is entirely different than it was a second ago. Every moment, your body is changing. You're constantly changing. It was nice to have that baby crying. I've just sent my son off to college. It's so amazing to watch a child grow up. And one of the most disconcerting things about it is the parent, no matter how the parent may think that they're a Vipassana meditator and very intelligent and so forth, the parent will feel, I am standing still watching this person grow. The person is born, I'm a young parent, and then the person, in a flash, leaves home and goes to college, and suddenly I have gray hair. Everything is changing all the time, every second. There are no 2 seconds that are alike. That same vision of reality that you can get by studying the history of Newfoundland, by studying the history of the earth, by following the migration of the caribou, that same sense of change upon change upon change, infinite change that we can't see any beginning. If it began when the earth was born, then what was going on before the earth was born? If it began when the Big Bang of the universe started than what was going on before the Big Bang started. That change is going on in your body right now, every single second. And to the extent you can just observe without adding any philosophy, any religion in, just observing your body every second, a continuous attempt to observe, you come upon ultimate reality. Ultimate reality means ceaseless change in every single molecule. When I say every single second is a long time. Every microsecond, every millisecond, ceaseless change is the one absolute truth of the universe happening in your body. Now, to the extent that a person feels that, and almost everybody has that experience when they take a 10-day Vipassana course, that they encounter within the mass of their own body the one absolute universal truth about the material universe. It's particulate, incessant change. Now, to the extent that a person feels that, and almost everybody has that experience when they take a 10-day Vipassana course, that they encounter within the mass of their own body the one absolute universal truth about the material universe. It's particulate, incessant change. When you have that experience, and people have different amounts, different intensities of this capacity to objectively observe, the next thing that happens is quite the opposite to what I, as a young, speculative, geologically minded person might have imagined. Because when you're on top of those rocks and wondering about the nature of the earth, the world seems quite cold, incomprehensibly cold. The reason for one's own birth seems terrifyingly unplumbable. But when you have that experience inside your own body, the exact opposite happens. It's as if a curtain of ignorance is lifted, or for a moment, part of a curtain of ignorance is lifted, and a great fountain of love and joy opens up in your heart. The recognition stops being about the incomprehensible magnitude of things, and the recognition becomes the fusion of all past moments, all of Pangaea, all of geology, all of the billions of Earth epochs, or the epochs of other Earths, or of other eras of the Big Bang, however you conceive of infinite time, all of that has culminated right now. This is the moment in which all the rest of all the eternities that will ever be will all be born out of this moment. There will be hundreds of billions of years of rocks, or if this planet is exterminated, there are actually many hundreds of billions of planets that we know of. And everything that's being formed is passing through this moment. All of karma, meaning all of causality, all of the future, all that will happen to us is being shaped right now. And the gift of each moment is the gift of the freedom to create ourselves in the next moment. And the entryway into this vision, as we discussed, there are two entryways. The first is ethics, the sense of communion, the sense of common life between us and all living things. And the second is the practice of Vipassana, meaning objective observation of the change of all body sensations all the time inside one's own self. This entryway leads to a sense of freedom in this moment to create the next moment. And since the entry requires communion or compassion, the obvious direction of wherever you would want to go in the future is the direction of human love, compassion, harmony among all beings, as well as you can create it, as often as you can create it, as far as you can create it. There's hardly a religion or a philosophy anywhere in the world that would disagree with that conclusion. But the uniqueness of Vipassana is that that conclusion is arrived at through personal experience based upon objective observation of one's own self at the level of body sensations, simply observing reality as it is, without elaborating any philosophy, without joining any cult or religion or belief system. It's the visionary extension of the scientific attitude. Often it is said that the scientific attitude culminates in, say, a cold, we almost conflate the two, a cold scientific worldview. But actually, if you extend the scientific worldview towards yourself in the manner I describe, you end up with a gush of affiliative feelings. If people take Vipassana meditation courses, the main experience they have is moments of such liberating joy, interspersed with hours of boredom, distress, fear, and other forms of very common human suffering. Because most of our minds, most of the day, most of our minds are caught up with immediate delusional preoccupation. There's a great deal of talk in America about using the terms like transcending the self that are connected to the New Age religions. And of course, that's a term that could be applied to the description of Vipassana I gave, but the difference is that while it's technically accurate, Vipassana moves you through yourself to liberate yourself from yourself. It is not a mere excited, euphoric fantasy union with something other than the self. And in reality, each one of us are burdened by enormous amounts of worries, problems, job problems, money problems, problems with the people we live with, problems with the people we wished we lived with. It's hard every day. So the avenue into the great fountain of love and compassion that we actually contain within us, the obstacle to that is our daily delusional existence. And meditation is hard work, a hard journey of that effort to focus, that effort to concentrate, and then first the effort to concentrate on breathing, then the effort to concentrate on body sensations, and in the process unearthing all of us that is so caught by what is transitory and ultimately unrealistic. All of us have many, many layers of that. And so all of us, when we meditate, find meditation to be incredibly joyous and liberating, but also very arduous, very hard work, actually quite a rigorous discipline. So if and when there are people who are inspired to come to a Vipassana course, I think they can't be overly enthusiastic. Their goals can't be too high, but they do have to recognize that the actual experience of a course is the experience of very, very hard work, more or less analogous to it's exhilarating to be hiking along the crests of the Long Range Mountains in Newfoundland, but to get there you have to hike up through mud and snow melt and fern jungles, and it's really a mess getting there. And that's the way every hike is, and that's the way every meditation course is also. Now, how does one live if one becomes a Vipassana meditator, if one takes a 10-day course, works one's way through all of one's own fears and worries and body pains, and completes the course and leaves feeling this opening into so much love and compassion and desire to build a world of harmony and communion? Well, how does one live every day? The answer is, well, you're stuck going back to the same old ordinary world. But a few anchors in the life of the Vipassana meditator. One anchor is, well, it's advised to meditate every day, a couple times every day. Human beings are sort of biphasic animals. We get up in the morning, we go to sleep in the evening, and that 24-hour cycle is actually deeply part of our psyche. So it's a good thing to be able to meditate twice a day every day to keep your life rooted in this, in the feelings, not so much the ideas of meditation are of less importance, the actual experience of meditating upon one's own body, meditating upon change, how everything you went through in that day that seems so incredibly important is all going to change. The next thing that keeps you rooted in the life of Vipassana, is remembering that it's ideal and best to feel an ethical communion, a state of care for all living things. But even if you don't feel it, you should live it. So there is an ethical practice, a moral practice that's very helpful to keep as a life discipline. For example, the practice of not killing. This generates a lot of humor in my house because I live in an old farm building in New England near an orchard, and orchards are the home of mice because they like to eat the roots of apple trees. Maybe you have this in Washington State also, a lot of mice eating up your apple orchards in the winter. So, but we have a house right near the orchard, in fact, in the orchard. So we have tons of mice entering our old basement, which is filled with holes between the stones. What do you do if you don't kill and your house is filled with mice? We live trap them, and I kid around about having my trap line of mice. But what does it do to your life if you live according to certain ethical precepts, even if at times they're a little clumsy or maybe even a little artificial? But there's a constant reminder in your life that the biggest commitment in life is not to kill. Not to kill anybody. Who gives you the right to kill a mouse? I don't really feel I have that right. So the life of Vipassana meditation centers around these 10-day meditation courses, and in some cases, people who've meditated many years take even longer than 10-day courses. Then there's meditating every day, twice a day, touching base with the reality of change in one's own body. Then there's the ethical precepts. And then, finally, maybe to close the talk, the other very rooting aspect of Vipassana meditation is there's the community of kindred souls, of people who've had the same sort of drift in their heart from birth, who aren't satisfied with the mere transient delusions that occupy almost all of human existence almost all the time. These kindred souls who, one way or another, one time or another, not literally, but in some metaphorical way, have stood on the top of some tundra mountain range and looked into eternity and understood that the preoccupations of daily life cannot possibly be the ultimate meaning of their life, and who have sought a different way, and who have sought a different way without trying to elaborate some fanciful answer about the creator of the world, who absolutely no one knows anything about, but instead have sought an alternative based upon reality and unambivalently rooted in ethics and compassion. So one of the best parts of Vipassana practice is to have Vipassana friends, go to meditation groups among kindred souls, have a meditation center, which you all of you happen to have quite nearby, a couple hours away, and to feel a part of other people who are in their hearts always walking along the same mountain ridge with you. I think I'll stop and maybe we can have questions.
The vow that you chose to dwell on about not killing, the very nature of our being, our antibody system is constantly killing other life forms.
Yeah, that's a good point. There was a, when the Buddha, said he rediscovered Vipassana. So that may mean it's such a natural thing to do, to meditate on the reality of yourself in an objective way. It's hard to imagine only one person discovered it. The Buddha himself said other people discovered it. So when he rediscovered this at that time in India, there were many similar teachings. He, like all great human breakthroughs, they don't occur in isolation, and there are many people working on similar problems. And there was a teacher at the same time, Mahavira, who preached that the most important thing is to kill nothing, ahimsa, the vow of nonviolence, and that we should consider the fact that we're constantly killing microorganisms. The followers of his religion, Jains, of whom there are now quite a few in the United States, they're religious people, not the lay people, wear a mask over their mouth in the hopes that they won't breathe in and kill anything. They have to walk barefoot because if you wear shoes, you might crush something, but if you walk barefoot, you'd be more sensitive. And to the Buddha, it looked like they were living a very crippled and fanciful existence, in which an obsession with not killing subsumed actually constructive ethical ways of living. It's, of course, impossible to live without killing something if we consider microorganisms. Or even, people sometimes ask, well, you know, like you eat cauliflower, isn't that awfully cruel to the poor little cauliflower? And you're very considerate of the mice. So the answer is that while you can draw this to some logical extremity, the emphasis in Vipassana, and we can trace it back to the emphasis given by the Buddha, is that it's not logically possible to walk on the earth without crushing it, or to breathe without breathing microorganisms, or to live without eating cauliflower. The criteria where it becomes illogical is when your heart is filled with a sense of concern, when you're making an intelligent discrimination to not harm, to not do evil, to bring love and compassion into the world. That's the right way of life. And where you draw the exact line, obviously, is a point of individual choice. There's no religion and no one cares what you do. To live a life of thoughtless destruction, which is in fact the norm, will not lead you to the creation of a world of love and compassion. So whether you do or don't eat cauliflower, the Jains don't eat potatoes because they feel pulling them out of the ground is too cruel, but taking a cauliflower is okay. I mean, those are subtle distinctions I myself don't go through. But the key thing about killing is what is in your heart as you do it. If you've thoughtfully taken concern and care in every step, I think you'll be helping to build a better world. And if you're not taking that thought and concern, then I don't think you'll be helping. So that would be the guideline I'd give.
Yes, thank you.
How do you make sure you have the discipline to meditate? I've sat before, I'm having trouble with the discipline of meditating.
I see. Yeah. You sat a 10-day course? Too. Yeah. Many people ask that question. After my first 10-day course, I did not meditate every day twice a day. Most people don't. Some people do. The change for me, and I think this would be true for all long-term committed meditators, the change for me happened when I kept accumulating evidence of how incredibly helpful it was to me to touch back down into that basic truth about life and get away from the delusions that would be spinning in my mind that would prevent me from meditating because I would imagine that some delusional activity was more important than meditating. So I would say to you, to someone who's taken some courses, who wants to continue but finds themselves faltering, the more you do meditate, the more you will accumulate authentic evidence, not authoritarian belief like you better meditate, you should meditate, it's good for you, but authentic evidence that it will help you, that it will bring you back to the truth. And the more times you experience that, the more times you will then become increasingly convinced, well, this is what I want to do. So have faith, not faith that meditation is good, but have faith in yourself that as you do meditate, you will increasingly become convinced of its value.
Just briefly, how did you come on to be a Vipassana meditator?
It depends how far back we take the question.
In the beginning. I mean,
to the beginning.
What was it that brought it to your attention and made you want to pursue it?
Okay. Well, I actually encountered Vipassana first in 1974. I was traveling in India with my wife. I had just completed my training in psychiatry. And we were traveling in India, say partly as adventurers and partly as seekers, and not able to tell the difference, too young to tell the difference between the two. And we studied and practiced quite a few different things. It was an era of freedom. The world still felt freer There was no war between Iran and Iraq yet. There was no destruction of Afghanistan yet. India and Pakistan were not standing off with nuclear weapons yet. So many people were traveling quite freely. And we heard about Vipassana, and it seemed less disappointingly cultic than much of what was being taught in India. So that seemed like worth giving a try. We took the course, and it seemed very good. I won't say I was completely swept off my feet. It had more integrity than anything I'd come upon. There was nothing that was artificial. There was nothing that was going to tamper with me in some quaint way. I have to take a new name, or I have to join a new religion, or I have to change the way I dress, or something like that. So it seemed filled with integrity and very worthwhile. Then I kept practicing, and my wife kept practicing, and the more we practiced, just like the answer I gave the woman, I said, well, but Jesus, this is really good. Every day that I do this, I feel better. Every night that I don't do this, I'm just more agitated. I'm not as happy. Every time I touch down into reality again, I feel like I know who I am, or I know what my life is. So then we go back, take another course, and we'd say, this is really good. So it was not, to me at all, like a religious conversion. To me, it was more like a scientist exploring the value of something and continuously getting reconfirmation of the integrity and the efficacy of the practice.
Okay, so to go back to what you were saying before, is like you have this moment of something profound, and then you have hours and hours and hours of this other stuff. And you say that when you sit, you have this experience builds, but when really you're having hours and hours and hours of this other stuff,
yeah.
You have to have a lot of faith that these moments are going to build.
Yeah.
When in reality, what you're experiencing is hours and hours and hours of the other stuff.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if you can comment.
Are you a meditator, or you're thinking?
I'm a failing meditator.
Have you taken a 10-day course?
Yeah.
Yeah. I see. And you took one course?
Yeah.
And by failing, you mean, what do you mean?
Well, I'm not meditating.
Yeah. That's common. I'll call it a failure. Not quite faith, I would say confidence. So, two examples spring to my mind, say from daily life. I was just looking at a book, it's actually an old book from 1984, a book by Dave Barry. The exact title I don't remember, it's something like How to Have a Baby, How to Create a Little Human Being in 9 Months, Using Only the Tools That You Probably Already Have Around Your Home. It's an extremely comical book by a very good writer about what it's like to be a father. He wrote it when he had a 3-year-old in his home. So if you have a child, for example, or this cute little crying thing who was here earlier, if you have one of those, you know, there are certainly times where you like to throw it away. Did I have faith that my child would grow up? Actually, no, I really didn't have faith in that at all. I can remember, for example, when my son was in elementary school, they had a 6th grade graduation, and they'd have to put on a play, and the 6th graders would put on this play. To me, it seemed fabulous, and if I had a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, I think, look at him and go, there's no way he can ever learn those lines. He can't even tie his shoes. How's he going to learn 20 minutes worth of lines? Did I have faith he'd be able to function in the 6th grade? No. But he did. So it isn't exactly faith, but confidence is something different. You have to go forward. Once you have a child, you have to go forward. And if you keep going forward, growth will occur. If you don't keep going forward, the danger happens. And does it happen? Sure, tragically. There are families and children who do not go forward. Same with education. Whatever your educational background was, you start high school, you start college. Do you really have faith you're going to graduate? I certainly didn't. So you don't have faith. I lacked confidence. I didn't think I'd ever make it. But you go forward. If you keep going forward, you do make it. But not everybody graduates. So the biggest error is to give up, to give yourself a negative label, say you're a failure. There are difficulties. The way to master the difficulties, if you can't keep going forward, like you want to be meditating, obviously you do, why would you come here to this talk, but you just can't get yourself to do it, then you need to seek some help. So if you had an assistant teacher on your course who you can get in contact with, you can ask for help there. If there are group sittings, there are group sittings, a lot of group sittings in the Seattle area. I think a number of different days a week there are group sittings. Go to a group sitting, everybody else is there. You make some friendships. You kind of hang out with these people. Maybe some of your questions are answered. That helps. At some point, going back and taking another course, well, it's hard, but you need to get that basic foundation built. If you keep going forward, you will graduate. If you keep parenting your child, they will grow up. If you keep trying, you will have that breakthrough, till you will feel, as I do, almost the opposite, which is, I wouldn't miss it for $1 million.
Did you ever find when you were developing your practice, or do you find now when you're recommending to people that, say, the practice of yoga is very supportive? And maybe some of the things that can come along with yoga, like fasting, some of the mindfulness of dietary procedures?
I've done small amounts of yoga, and in general, I've been very concerned with fitness and health. We try to avoid specific recommendations because we don't want Vipassana to become filled with many rules, like you should eat like this, you should exercise like this, you should do this yoga posture. We want Vipassana to have that simple integrity as I described it, a meditation on the truth of change, a feeling of love and compassion for all other beings. That's it. However, if you do those practices, if you are a meditator, all meditators find they have an increased consciousness of care for their own body. If you're supposed to be concerned with mice and caribou, you should be a lot more concerned with yourself. We are naturally selfish, self-caring animals. The more you become attuned to yourself, the more you will awaken to what is healthy and good for you. So there is very commonly an overlap in interest of the kind exactly what you're describing. Concerned with diet, concerned with specific kinds of exercises that are more nurturing and life-giving than merely competitive or aggressive. So I wouldn't make it a rule, but I'd say it's a common happenstance that there will be a harmony between what you're describing and Vipassana. Yeah.
What is your own meditative pattern? Times that you meditate, the duration of your meditation?
On a daily basis, yeah. I meditate every morning. I used to meditate the first thing when I get up. Then due to various things, driving kids to school, stuff like that, I now meditate after breakfast, before work, a little later in the morning. And then I meditate every evening, typically the last thing I do in the evening. But now, as I'm getting a little older, I'm trying to shift it earlier because I do, you know, an older person falls asleep more easily in the evening. So, yeah, I don't know. Anybody falls asleep. No, I used to not fall asleep as easily. So, let's say, typically the first thing in the morning, but I've made a shift there. Typically the last thing in the evening, and I'm making a shift there. So it's a dynamic pattern that does change over time. I meditate for an hour every morning and every evening. On weekends, there's a variation that's situationally specific. If you know you're going to do something on a weekend evening, for example, it's impossible to come home and meditate at 11 o'clock. It's ridiculous. You'll be asleep in 1 minute. Meditating is relaxing when you do it at home, so it can be too relaxing. So then meditate at 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon before I go out and do anything. So there's some life-giving flexibility to the system. But basically, first thing in the morning, first thing in the evening is the basic pattern.
practicing psychiatrist who's dealt with people with all kinds of mental illnesses, and could you speak a little bit about the efficacy of Vipassana for those who are suffering from different kinds of mental diseases?
I'm being set up. Right?
Yeah. But it's a question that comes up all the time.
Yeah.
And maybe there's people who would, I certainly would, I confronted it myself a lot. And
yeah.
Maybe there are people who would.
In order to be able to take a meditation course, you have to be able to cooperate in a systematic way, day in and day out, with other people and with rules and regulations that make a group course possible, and with the ardors of the process itself. Someone who cannot cooperate, who cannot endure over a reasonable period of time in perseverance, someone who's incapable of sustained participation in a group cannot benefit from a Vipassana course. So that's criteria one. Second criteria is that the method of Vipassana is to observe one's sensations objectively as continuously as possible. Undoubtedly being disrupted millions of times, always returning to the effort to observe objectively. So someone whose capacity for sustained effort and observation is dramatically overwhelmed and disrupted by severe mental states can't benefit from a course and will be overwhelmed and subsumed by those extreme mental states. So those are the two criteria. Now, to translate those into diagnostic nomenclature would be beyond, you know, the effort of an hour and one talk. But people who can't cooperate, can't participate, can't follow rules and regulations, can't endure in an effort to observe, who are overwhelmed by extreme mental states of emotion or extreme states of irrationality, obviously cannot benefit from a course. But all people, all of us, to some extent, fit what I just said. And so the question is, to what extent? And the answer is, well, you read the course guidelines, and can the person you're thinking about participate in the guidelines of a 10-day course? So it's actually, there's been many efforts in order to be helpful to people and not be harmful to people. As you know so well, Peter, we've spent a great deal of time trying to sort out who should not come. And the answer is very few people should not come. But really the clarification should not come through the use of psychiatric diagnostic terms, but it should come through an analysis of what is necessary to participate in a course, and does this person have the capacity to participate at the level that's required for reasonable success. Generally speaking, people who are acutely and severely disturbed should not come at that time until their level of distress is modulated and modulatable.
Courses are often without charge. Could you explain how that's possible?
I'm really being set up. These are great questions. Very good point. I wanted to emphasize that and forgot it. It's amazing to see. Meditation has become quite a common term in America. You know, like if you read even, say, psychiatry journals, there's always an article on meditation. It improves your blood pressure or something like that. And it's everywhere, you know, TV shows and so forth. I'm totally in favor of all that. I think it's a good thing. But none of that has anything to do with what I talked about or what Vipassana is about. Vipassana is about a path of realization. It's not a tactic or a gimmick. It's not a health technique, although it's certainly, as the question from the previous question from the back implied, it certainly will lead to improved health, but it's not a health tactic. Because Vipassana is based upon simple reality, which nobody owns, because its outflow is to live a life of harmony, of social love, of compassion. So in its origins and in its outflows, it belongs to no one, it belongs to everyone. There can't possibly be anybody who's actually had a significant Vipassana experience who would have the temerity to claim it as their own and charge for it. Vipassana belongs to the world. It's a common property. Having someone saying, I'm a Vipassana teacher, it's my product, and if you come to me, you can buy it from me, that would be like selling the air. It may be someday there will be people selling air. We're not that far from it, but still, I think it would be a criminal activity when it's done. So Vipassana, real Vipassana, I emphasize this because there are people who use the word Vipassana and sell it. Real Vipassana is always taught for free because the teacher of it got it for free, just as a gift. They got it from their own teacher who got it, really, you could say, from the world. It's just the truth of life. That's all it is. It's just a free common property. No one can charge for that. Therefore, it's always taught entirely for free in a center like the center. You have a couple hours from here, south of here. It's taught for free, and the only way the center survives is if someone takes the course and they like the course and they give a donation at the end of the course. And if enough people do that, then the center thrives. And in fact, wherever centers are established, they do thrive. Sometimes people take that as a little magical, you know, like, wow, why are people giving the money? But I don't see it as that different than, like, one of my common examples is I've liked to hike on the Appalachian Trail and things like the Long Trail in Vermont. I think the analogy out here would be something like the Pacific Crest Trail. Here are these magnificent trails which actually take an enormous amount of work, enormous, a staggering amount of work. And when you hike on them for free. No one would charge that you have to pay to hike across the Pacific Crests. They are a common property. And Vipassana is like that too. So people will donate time and effort to build this path because it's a beautiful piece of common property, and we all hope everybody will take a walk on the path.
I'm kind of staggered by length of the time of the course.
10 days?
That gives this 10-day chunk.
Yeah.
You've got to look at how can I arrange my schedule?
Yeah.
And the other thing is the time of 2 hours a day, which feels like this huge chunk. I don't feel like I have enough time to begin with. And I'd like to hear you speak to that.
Yeah, those are very good questions. The questions from the people, a couple of people who said things like, I've meditated, but I'm not meditating regularly, or how can I meditate regularly? The best answer, which is not as satisfying to give verbally, the best answer is, if you find the value in this, then you won't look upon it as a chore to do every day. You'll want to do it. If I turned your question around into my value system, I would kid you and say something like, well, how do you have the time to go to work? How do you have the time to sleep? The obvious answer is you feel you can't not do those things. You must sleep or you would be sick. You must work or you would starve. So actually what appears to be a chronological problem is a question of values, and you can't really value Vipassana until you've taken it. Therefore, there's some judgment on your part as to whether what you hear about it, what you read about it, what you may discuss with some people who practice it, grips you enough to give that time. 10 days is a lot of time if you consider that meditation is probably taught all over the city as it is where I live, you know, half an hour on Thursday evening, meditation group that will bring you to total enlightenment within 6 weeks. So here, Vipassana, you have to take 10 days and it won't even enlighten you, and you still have to meditate for many years. But, you know, if you hear the ring of authenticity in this, and you hear this is an incredibly valuable, life-transforming, life-giving, lifelong practice, then 10 days does not seem like a lot. Everybody gets at least 2 weeks vacation. And so, realistically, you can get there, but, you know, you make the judgment whether it's worth it. The 2 hours twice a day is a somewhat different question. I would say at least one of those hours you totally and completely waste. You know, one of my eccentricities that I like to tease people with is that I've never lived in a house with a television. I've actually never seen a television program. I've seen baseball games on TV. I've seen presidential debates on TV, but I've never seen a TV program since I've been an adult. As a child, I saw a few TV programs. I don't know what a TV program is. Now, if you feel you're getting so much out of watching TV programs, keep doing it. But I feel I get more out of meditating. There must be things in your life which you could easily eliminate with joy. And then you'd have free time to meditate. And then also there would be times, and there are definitely times in my life, where it's a matter of discipline, meaning I push aside something with effort in order to pursue this beloved discipline. The same way that my work sometimes requires me, I want to complete something by 6 and there's this emergency or this phone call or this chart or this consultation and I don't get home till 7:30. I don't like it, but I have to do it. So sometimes my meditation has that power behind it, meaning, well, I'm committed to it and I'm going to do it no matter what, and if it takes up my time this or that way, I'll do it. So my two answers are, the biggest part of the answer is, if you do it and if you find it valuable, your value system will shift, and instead of it being an intrusion upon your life, 2 hours intruded into your day, it will be your life. You will seek it. You will love it. You will cherish it. It won't be an intrusion into the day. It will be the heart of your day. That's the biggest part of the answer. And the little part of the answer is almost everybody wastes time. If you waste a little less time, you've got some time. And also some determination and some devotion and some tenacity will help. It's quite doable.
One more question. Yes.
So that leads me to ask, if have you always actually been able to sit for an hour, or did you have to work up to sitting for a whole hour?
If you take a 10-day course, you learn to sit for an hour. You learn to sit for an hour undisturbed. It is hard. I don't know whether the laughter is from people who've experienced how difficult it is, or if, yeah. So that is taught. You learn it. Still, when I came home after my first course, that hour still, you know, it was doable, but it was hard and long. Now, of course, it's deeply integrated into my life. I wouldn't make that the core of the concern. It's the timing on the clock. The thing I would emphasize is, if you keep going forward, the benefits will appear. And when the benefits appear, you'll want to go forward. And that would be much more important. Supposing you could only sit 45 minutes, well, so what? Keep going.
Thank you. Let's all give him a minute.